Good evening. I'm Stephanie. I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is July 8th, 2011. I have a sponsor. Talked to her yesterday. I call her every day. Can't always reach her. And I have a home group, and that is Midtown Group, as Sam shared. And a couple things I want to make sure. I just say them so they don't forget. I'm sponsored, which means I have somebody in my life who knows everything about me, and it has been vitally, vitally important for me on this path to be sponsored, to be taken through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, to be guided further and further into deeper levels of service, and to be constantly turned outward to try to help others. And without a sponsor repeating these suggestions to me over and over again, I never stop needing to hear it. I never stop needing to surrender to it. I don't know what I would do. So I'm very grateful to the 12th step and to the people that practice it, because I'm pretty sure if I wasn't dead, I would absolutely be locked away someplace not fun on this night. So, and the other thing is that I do have a little bit of a crying reflex, and my sponsor has assured me it's nothing to be ashamed of. When my spirit wakes up, I get choked up. So you're going to have to probably deal with a little bit of that. And I'm sorry if it makes anyone uncomfortable, but I can't help it. Okay. My job is to tell you a little bit about what it was like, what happened, and what it was like now. And I'm going to do that hopefully as honestly as I possibly can. My hope is to just have a message for anyone in this room, a message of hope that might be in some darkness. Whether you're newly sober, whether you've returned from drinking and have been sober before, or whether you've been sober a long time and have fallen on dark days, because I know that happens frequently in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's not just the newcomer that can often need a message of hope. So having said that, I also, since I have a little bit of time, we're used to like 20 minutes at Midtown. People drive like 5 hours, and we're like, cool, thanks, you have 20 minutes. So this is, I wanted to read something that has changed my life recently, has revolutionized my thinking a little bit. I was at the North Carolina State Conference recently. Maybe some of you guys were there. And it was awesome. Got to hear Tom I and some other great speakers. And I was perusing the literature table. You know how we do. There's like all the literature and all the, you know, all the AA paraphernalias there at this conference. And my grand sponsor, Jerry W. from Apex, North Carolina, if anyone knows him, I don't know why I'm dropping names. I try not to do that. But anyway, this guy said, he picked this up. He goes, you need to read this appendix. It's it's one of the appendices in the back of Alcoholics Anonymous Comes of Age, which is a book that I've seen around for 10 years. I've never read it until now. And he said, just read this appendices in the back. And I did. And he said, it's probably one of the best pieces of writing on this entire literature table. And in it was this golden nugget description of alcoholism. I mean, to me, it resonates with every nuance of what I've discovered about myself in the last 3.2 years, especially. But who's counting? So this guy, my AA history is not perfect, so those of you historians in here, forgive me if I say something that's not accurate, but to the best of my regurgitation from what I read when I read this, is this guy, Henry Tybout, may not be pronouncing his name right, he is like the big daddy psychiatrist that like came on the scene in like 1944. Okay, he was like revolutionizing psychiatry with some of the big boys back in the day, right after Carl Jung and them, like the next generation of psychiatrists. And he's not as known as Silkworth, because we've got the doctor's opinion, so everyone knows Dr. Silkworth, but he was as vital and important to the pioneering of AA, and he basically, just like Silkworth, was trying to help alcoholics in a psychiatric hospital, like in Rochester, New York. It was like the best psychiatric hospital in the country, and he couldn't do it. He couldn't break through, just like Silkworth with the 20 years and the no effect. And he saw like two or three people touched by AA, the program of AA, and then he was able to help them after they got sober through AA, and it made him a just a cheerleader for this thing. And really, he put his job on the line, and he ended up getting the medical board, like their big conference, I forget what it's called, like the big medical conference, to let Bill Wilson read his essay. And anyway, it's really, really cool, this appendix. A lot of you guys have this book. If you've never, like, read it, the Henry Tybalt one. It doesn't have, like, an appendix 2 or anything. But anyways, this is the description that he gave. Characteristic of the so-called typical alcoholic is a narcissistic, egocentric core dominated by feelings of omnipotence, intent on maintaining at all costs. Standbys. I brought these. Let me start over. Characteristic of the so-called typical alcoholic is a narcissistic, egocentric core dominated by feelings of omnipotence, intent on maintaining at all costs its inner integrity. While these characteristics are found in other maladjustments, they appear in relatively pure culture in alcoholic after alcoholic. In a careful study of series of cases, Silman recently reported that he felt he could discern the outlines of a common character structure among problem drinkers, and that the best terms he could find for the group of qualities noted was defiant individuality and grandiosity. In my opinion, those words were accurately chosen. Inwardly, the alcoholic brooks no control from man or God. He, the alcoholic, is and must be master of his destiny. He will fight to the end to preserve that position. And that is, you know, Dr. Silkworth talks a little bit about that and the doctor's opinion about being pulled back from the gates of hell, and some of us pursue it to you know, death and whatever. And I mean, that's my experience. So my sobriety date, like I said, is 2011, but I first came to AA in 2003. And I'm going to just give you a little bit about what it was like before that. Very standard textbook alcoholic story. Partied a lot in high school. I was raised in a decent home, immigrant parents. A little bit of trouble for me on that front. With the immigrant parents, my mom was a little older at the time, and I was born in 71, and she was 43 when she adopted me. So by the time I was in high school, you know, she was in her 50s, and she had already prematurely grayed, so people would always refer to her as my grandmother. And for some reason, this really upset me. So this was the precipice of my fighting on the playground. Someone would be like, "Was that your grandmother?" And I would just be like, boom. I don't know why. It just really hurt me. And so there was something going on there that some maladjustment started to rear its head when I was in elementary school. But my parents were amazing. I mean, they were hard workers. They were both from Germany. And, my dad fled here before World War II ended. My mom came much, much after. Very different upbringings. Both of them, though, came from altruistic families, very anti-Third Reich. Both families were hiding Jewish families in their home. I mean, they were raised in environments where they knew what it was to sacrifice their own needs for the well-being of someone else. All that kind of stuff. I mean, I was raised that way. I was raised to say, "May I be excused," when I got off the table. I was raised to drink milk only at dinner. I mean, my mom was strict. Her motto to me was suffer in silence. And don't syndicate, you know, your sorrows all the time. No one wants to hear that. It's selfish. That kind of, you know, stoic message. And I definitely retaliated, as you'll soon hear, from that message. But I had a great upbringing. And I grew up in a nice area. And I got into high school. And I just started partying. I first got drunk at 9. I don't know what could lead a 9-year-old to drinking. I don't have hardly any memory of it. I just know that somebody that was babysitting my friend had liquor, and I was there, and I got a hold of it, and I got drunk, and they threw me in a bathtub. It was just kind of a funny, cute story. I remember I was wearing a T-shirt that said Foxy Lady. I don't know why I remember that. It was a decal. And that's it. And then to the best of my knowledge, I did not get drunk again until the summer before 9th grade. And that night I passed out off the bike path in the woods, was carried back to the party, and you know, that's it. I mean, I just started drinking, partying, drugs sometimes. You know, I was one of just skipped school a lot, smoked cigarettes, wore concert T-shirts, you know. Boys were everything, and rules were to be broken and all of that. Kind of just hung out with partiers. But at the same time, I did all right in school until ninth grade. This is basically the trajectory of, like, enter alcohol. Like, in eighth grade, all my classes were advanced. By the end of ninth grade, I was in consumer math. I'd been plucked from geometry, which was the advanced math I was put in after taking algebra in eighth grade, to be in consumer math, where they, like, teach you to write checks and just try to keep hope alive, you know what I mean? And by 10th grade, I was taken out of my high school and put in an alternative school for truancy, because I never went to class. So, you know, that's common for all of us. And I drank and drank and partied. There was absolutely no talk of alcoholism or trouble in that area for me, because I hung out in a neighborhood with a bunch of kids that did the same thing. We all had good parents. We were lucky. And it just seemed like we were going to grow out of it, you know, much like many of us, you know, the way we started. It seemed like we would grow out of it. Our parents are hopeful we'll grow out of it. Plus, my parents were from Germany, so drinking beer and beer steins and festivities were part of the culture. My dad was an advocate of drinking, and my older brother Michael, who is my hero in life, you know, hanging out with my dad, who had this cool bar built in the basement, and drinking. I mean, that was a huge part of our family. Christmas and Thanksgiving, we could get my mom to do shots. She never really drank, but we'd get her a little buzzed once a year, and that was like the big excitement in our family. And it was fun. I mean, when I think of those times, I remember them nostalgically and warmly. I don't remember them with a dark cloud or anything. You know, they were good days in a pretty happy home. And the future looked very bright, and to my family and to me. There were certainly some jags of emotional disturbances mixed in there, some pretty big ones. In sixth grade, I faked a suicide attempt. And again, it was just, I mean, my character was so dramatic that it didn't seem like that big of a deal. Looking back, I can see the self-centeredness. There's no way to know that without a lot of work in Alcoholics Anonymous and understanding the gravity of self-centeredness. But faking a suicide to get attention is a major red flag for severe self-centeredness, which is what I did. And I had to get my stomach pumped because I took some of my mom's, some medication she had said if you take it with alcohol, you'll become drowsy. And I got grounded. I wasn't allowed to go watch cable TV at my friend's house, and so that was my solution to that. And I knew, and so it made me fall asleep, and I sprinkled the pills around the bathroom. I got into some, like, orange or peach schnapps, took a few shots of that and waited, and I passed out on the bathroom floor. Ended up getting my stomach pumped. And so that's, after that, we started, like, some family therapy. But always hope would be restored, you know? And but I kept drinking and letting everybody down, and it was just like that. It was like, you know how we restore hope and then blow the roof off the place. And then we level the city, we take people with it, that whole thing. I kept doing that every few years, and the consequences were getting worse. And the drinking and the partying was there, but that nobody was questioning that. What they were questioning was my emotional stability, and which they should have. And when I graduated high school, I hung around for a couple years in junior college. I don't know what people went off to college. I missed the whole, my parents, like I said, are immigrants, so they weren't really banging that drum about, you know, managing expectations for, like, college, like filling out applications and stuff. So when people got that done and went off to college, I was like, when did you guys, like, do that? Did they have a class or who told you? I just missed the whole thing, and they went off, so I went to junior college, and my dad kept saying, you should get a government job, and I was, like, offended. I was like, he just did not think I was college material, I don't think. And but I went to junior college, and then I ended up in Colorado, and I saw this guy that I had a crush on in high school, like from ninth grade to 12th grade. You know that guy that goes to a different high school, you see him around sometimes and you have the biggest crush on him and you're like, he would never like me, but he's so cute. Well, he showed up on the scene and he, like, liked me. And he lived in Colorado. He had, like, hitchhiked there in 1990, which was, like, a very cool thing to do. Being a deadhead was, like, the coolest. And he was a white guy with dreadlocks and, you know, he smelled, and but he was cute, and I loved him. And I ended up going back to Colorado with him, and that started a 5 years of me being in Colorado. My drinking got worse. My parents started getting concerned. Drugs became a part of the story. I mean, I just started really blowing things up. I mean, to fast forward, it just did not get better, you know? I mean, things with that guy ended. Years went on. It didn't come to A the first time until I was 31, but Colorado, lived in Steamboat, a lot of humiliation there, incomprehensible demoralization was just that portfolio of shame, you know what I'm talking about, all the places you can't go that turns your stomach, all the people you think about that turn your stomach, all the situations and just the humiliation and shame. It was like the weight of my past was starting to choke me out a little bit. But I was, you know, I was still vigilant and still trying to fight through it. And eventually, basically, guys, what happened was a lot of things happened. I graduated from college somehow. There was another hopeful period. We've all done that. I don't know what it comes from, but I had a hopeful period, and I graduated college. I did well somehow. And when I graduated, the look on my parents' face, I was 29, so I got out a little late. But I got out from University of Maryland, and my parents, you know, immigrants, my brother and I, the first to graduate, and like our whole genealogy that we know of, were so proud. I mean, they're just proud. My parents, you know, meager upbringing, so they weren't like, my mom gave me like a $30 gift certificate to the Gap for my college graduation. My friends were getting cars. I was like, God, the envy. And, but they were so proud. And that really was my first real sinking beneath the level of hope was when I graduated and I had to get a job, you know, a real job. And I got one because it was the tech boom. And there were jobs everywhere. I mean, you'll recall, 2000, it was like software companies booming everywhere. You know, my recruiter was like, can you do, you know, 20 interviews this week? I was like, I mean, okay. And I got a job and for this great software company, and I spoke German fluently, so it was based in Germany, and they were just like, you're in. And I was like, okay. And I started becoming part of a professional corporate culture to the best of my ability, and it did not go well. Not because I couldn't clean up, suit up, show up, but the way people were talking and the way I was living, there was such a gap that it was getting harder and harder to have that double life and have it be okay, you know. I just couldn't do it. And, you know, I had a boyfriend that lived at the beach in a trailer. I mean, just to give you an idea of a double life, he was a reclusive alcoholic who lived in a trailer miles away from Bethany Beach, Delaware, next to a chicken coop. And my favorite place was to be there with him in that trailer. Billy knows, because when he talks about him and Lynn down by the river, I'm still like, yes! I mean, I still romanticize that. It's getting better, but he had that sort of reclusive, back in the woods, you know, and I loved it there. And he would be like, it doesn't make sense. You got to get out there. You went to college. And I was like, I don't want to go out there. I want to stay here with you and just go to shows, and we'll go to, you know, music festivals and do drugs and get drunk and never grow old, and we'll just always have fun forever. Amen. You know, and it just doesn't work. And he and I were a horrible mess. And anyway, shortly after that, I wound up not being able to stop drinking. That's what got me to A for the first time in 2003. That guy, the incomprehensible demoralization as a result of that relationship, you know, it was abusive. You know, I remember him throwing me down the stairs. I was in a blackout of his trailer and throwing my stuff, and I was bleeding. My knee was bleeding, I remember, and I was driving home with one hand over my eye, like a 2.5-hour drive home. And scared to death because I'd already had 3 DWIs, okay? And someone's not learning their lesson, right? Do we learn? No. And so scared. And I remember my friend Jennifer saying, Stephanie, you know, you have to break up with him. And I remember thinking, am I the only one that now sees that he really loves me? Is that weird? And no one was understanding my thinking. And that's, you know, so I couldn't deal with life anymore. It was like being sober was so unbearable to me that I just got to that place where I couldn't stop drinking. And that's what got me to AA the first time, was 2 weeks of in and out of consciousness. After that guy broke up with me, I moved to the beach, quit that job. right, that I had for almost 4 years, quit the job to go back to the beach and bartend in this dive bar in Bethany. This is called Seeking Lower Companions in the Big Book. You'll find they talk about this. And destroying my parents. You know what I mean? This is like their child who is quitting their good job to go live in Bethany Beach and bartend in this dump, okay? And rationalizing it all the while. You know, Mom, Dad, I'm a free bird. You know this racket. I can't be chained down like this. This corporate life, I've tried it. It's sucking my soul out of my ear. Do you want me to be miserable? Don't you want me to be happy? You know, like, I'll find my way. It's just not going to be this traditional lifestyle. I didn't know how much it terrified me. I mean, there's a little truth in that for my personality type, but not... It was so much fear. And I remember my dad crying on my bed before I moved back to the beach. And he said, why are you doing this? You know, and it was, how many times have we heard that, right? Why are you doing this? And just having no answer for that question. And breaking hearts over and over again. And people that love us looking in our eyes and saying, why are you doing this? And we don't know. Because we don't have the words for this spiritual malady that we are so deeply afflicted with. And for me, no therapist had been able to handle it. This is my experience. I tried many cocktails of medications over the years. And it seemed that none of them could find their way to my spirit, my experience. And as a result of that, hopelessness got larger and larger. Because the way I viewed it, there was no solution for what was wrong with me. Nothing was quite fitting the bill. And but I would play along because, you know, our symptoms are just like so many symptoms in the psychiatric world. So when they're like, you have severe ADHD coupled with bipolar and a dash of rejection sensitivity disorder, take this. I'm like, okay, you know, and hope. And then nothing works. And that's my experience. This is not an anti-med proclamation. Okay, that's my experience. And so that guy broke up with me, and I quit that job. It was so weird that I quit that job that my boss was like, where are you going? And I was like, I got a really good offer, which was a lie. But I couldn't tell anyone that I'm quitting this great job to go bartend at Magnolia's in Bethany, because that's so crazy. And they were like, well, where? And I was like, it's a secret. I don't want to jinx it. I mean, just totally gave my 2 weeks' notice. But, you know, this whole thing. And I go back to the beach, and I moved there. I mean, U-Haul truck, the whole nine yards, to go live a mile away from that trailer. So maybe that guy in the trailer might take me back someday, you know? And that's what I did. And I lasted 2 weeks from that point until I couldn't stop drinking. And I woke up one day, and my life flashed before my eyes, and I could not bear it. You know what I mean? And I had done the math. You know, alcohol had the ability to instantly change my perception of how I viewed the world. I knew that. I was fired from a bartending job once a few years prior. It had been my job all through college. I was fired from my drinking. It was the first time that had happened to me. These people were like family at the time. I'm backing up a little bit, but I was 27 years old when that happened. And they fired me, and it was so shocking. And I went to my mom's house and did two shots of whiskey, which I had done, a double. I had done that at least 500 times before. But I did that double shot, and it instantly restored hope. And from then on, I mean, I knew my solution. And so I just couldn't stop drinking, and I couldn't come out of my house. And some people at the beach, actually a couple times I did leave the house, and I was, you know, very drunk and looked like a maniac, like bikini top, sweatpants, like knit hat, glasses, crazy. driving around, I remember I have like a photograph snapshot of myself driving over the median, blaring the Red Hot Chili Peppers, thinking I'm like some hot video girl, which was the furthest thing from the truth, and going to that guy's trailer and going in there. I remember walking in there. And he wasn't there. I had like a flash memory of that. But so a loving friend called my mom, and my mom and her best friend came and got me. And they took me home and had an intervention with my dad and my mom and the pastor from their church. And I did what we do, and we're backed up against the corner. And I promise with every crocodile tear I could find that this was the wake up call I needed. And that night, I went to bed. I thought maybe that was going to be all right. I went to bed and I was like, man, I am never drinking again. I mean, I was heavy-hearted. My dad was crying again. I was, like, done breaking people's hearts. I was really done with it. Like, game over. No more hurting these people. And I laid there in my bed in so much pain, and I had to drink. And you guys know what that feels like. There is no choice in the matter. You can't explain that to a non-alcoholic. It's impossible. So if you've tried and gotten frustrated, take your foot off that pedal, because it ain't going to happen. They're never going to get it. I've tried to explain it to my family. They don't get it. Even though they've seen it, they still think, my mom today could be convinced that I don't need AA anymore with the right angle. I mean, that's not true. But, I mean, it's possible, I think. I mean, I did it before, which you're about to hear. But they had that intervention. I went to bed, and I couldn't do it. And I looked around, and they'd hid the liquor. And I was like, you know how we are at our parents' house. I was like, it's either in the car or in the shed, both of which were locked. I found the key in, like, 7 seconds. And I tried the shed first, and there it all was. So I started drinking in that shed, and I accidentally passed out there. And my very, very weakened in the spirit mom had to wake her daughter up in her shed the next morning after this intervention. And that was it. I agreed to go to an AA meeting that night. And it was actually my mom's friend came over that morning after the shed. You know, I went in the house. My mom didn't say anything. She just walked away. She the loving, oh, my God, that was done. And I knew it. Not my dad. My dad could not. My dad could not be derailed from that posture towards his daughter. I mean, he just couldn't. And some woman came and read me this AA literature called "Letter to a Woman Alcoholic." They've since changed it, but she was a non-alcoholic who carried the message to me by simply reading that pamphlet. When she started reading it, I was sitting in a chair, and I thought, if she doesn't get away from me, I'm going to kick her in the face. I was so angry. She was, like, leaning down with her. She's grown up with me. My mom's best friend, knew me since I was 5, with her leg across my lap, reading it in this loving way, and I was so hostile and rageful. I mean, I had just crawled through the backyard from the shed, for Christ's sake. You know what I mean? I'm not feeling good. But she started reading it. And the power of identification broke through all of that. That is why it is so important that we identify with one another. And I went to my first AA meeting that night. My mom took me there. It was a Midtown meeting, which is my home group. You know, throughout my area where I live, there's a lot of sort of Midtown expansion meetings, if you will, and this was one of them. And it said YP. In the where and when, they had, you know, that lady Nancy had the where and when, and she highlighted it, and I went with my mom, and I'm 31 at the time, and there's, like, it looked like there was a bunch of, like, high school kids in there. I was like, what the F? I mean, I'm, like, seeing double as it is. It was my first shower that day. Like, I let my hair air dry. Like, it was the best I could do. I still looked insane. Walked in with my mom, and the first thing I did was lie. I said to the then Mike, who Billy knows, who I, you know, I'm just going to tell you I love this man. He was there, and he introduced himself to me, and I said, what does YP mean? He said, young people, and I was like, well, I'm 29. Am I too old? Which was a lie. I was 31. And he said, just no, sit down. And that was my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that night, what happened to me continued. That identification happened again. And you know what came to me through this guy who's still sober? He, like myself, returned to drinking after this night, but is, you know, on a spiritual path, arm in arm with me today, thank God. But he carried that message to me that night because he talked about being at work and almost getting in a knife fight. That resonated with me. I was like, and everyone was like, oh yeah. And I was like, oh my God, you can talk like this here? Like, it resonated with me. And it gave me hope, because that anger and that temper that I had, which I didn't really get into much, but that is something that I was so ashamed of. I mean, I was someone that had broken furniture, put my fist through walls. I hadn't had a boyfriend that I hadn't been violent with. It was always the guys that got it, which I didn't want to share that. You know, now I do. That's part of what I'll talk about here in a minute, about what it's like now. But, you know, I couldn't really be honest about these things, you know, because, you know, it's just too much. And but I related, and I stayed there, and I got. It took me a year and a half to get an actual sobriety date from that night, because after I realized, you know, what we're doing here, which is abstinence, I was so 100% sober was too much. So I tried to secretly take pills, painkillers, and be in AA and do all the stuff whilst very high on opiates. And that did not work. Eventually brought me to my knees, and I did get an honest sobriety date. And I stayed sober for a few years. I stayed sober almost 5 years. Actually, that's not true. I stayed sober a little over 4 years. And but my sobriety, although I had great teachers in my life, Billy and Lynn, two of them. I mean, you guys have seen me. They've seen me up and down. You know what I mean? Just the bondage of self and the anger that literally locks me in, you know. And there are people that have seen it, and I have had to show my face and show my face because I can't duck this thing. But basically, my sobriety was about a guy, you know. And I didn't know that's what was happening. I can look back and say that now. And there's so many other aspects of it. You know, I never got a real God. I never understood the truth about what was wrong with me. And not because people weren't pointing me in the right direction. It was no one's fault. Granted, I was a member of a home group that was a little immature, and there were some things that were a little, let's say, not lending themselves to spiritual growth that were, I don't know, maybe even normal for a bunch of young people. I mean, I was so immature. I was right at home. It's not like, I mean, it only took me 5 seconds to feel weird about being 31. 10 minutes later, I was like, hell yeah, we're all living like teenagers. And, but anyway, I didn't grow my spiritual life. And when something happened, and it did, I had no leg to stand on. And I wasn't on this path just to help others. I wasn't on this path to grow spiritually. I wasn't on this path to grow God and shrink Stephanie, as one of my favorite speakers, Ralph White, always says. Grow God, shrink Ralph, whole deal, whole deal. I love that guy. If you ever can find him on one of these XM speakers, Ralph W. from Compton, actually. He's amazing. Anyways, none of that was happening. It was like, get the boyfriend, do all the service, did a lot of service, look good in AA, the boyfriend comes back, and that was it. That was what I was doing for years, and then the boyfriend left AA. And when that happened, and I think Lynn and Billy, you guys knew Felipe maybe, and when he left AA, you know, he was one of the first, you know, 9 years sober. It was like very dramatic, like what? We've seen that so many times now that, you know, and thank God we've grown up since then, this dramatic, you know, posture towards stuff like that. But when he wasn't alcoholic anymore, which you see a lot in young people, you get through college, get your job, not alcoholic, was a phase all the time, happens all the time. It's pandemic right now. It's every week there's somebody else. But he was one of the first in my experience and in that kind of phase of things. And I remember thinking, I'm not either. If he's not, I'm not. Like, no real, what does it say about the first step? That we have to know to our innermost self, you know, I didn't have any of that. And I drank again. And at that time, I had gotten so sick before I drank again, my sponsor, God Lover, lovingly let me go. Because, I mean, I was a nightmare, impenetrable, so dark and angry that you could not talk to me. And there was this one woman, Valerie D. in Richmond, some of you might know her, she like was not afraid of it. And she started helping me a lot. And I think I was too far gone. I mean, who knows? I eventually surrendered to the drink. That's it. I mean, one day I called that guy Felipe. I knew he didn't have many friends. He'd been in AA since he was 18. Prior to that, he was in a rehab for 3 years. So he's, like, out there trying to, like, you know, adjust to, like, non-alcoholic life. And I knew he was struggling. So I said, let's go to the bar. That's a healthy scene. I didn't tell you that we planned a wedding, by the way, and canceled it right after my dad died. That was, like, the darkness that led to all this. But we went and drank together, and I remember the relief was so profound that I just started crying. He was like, well, are you sad that you drank? And I just was like, no, it just felt so good after 10 months of rot gut untreated alcoholism. And my trajectory leaving AA was like this, just a nosedive. I now know I'm lucky because I made it back. And there, I ran out of lies to tell myself so quick. And somebody called me, and I came back to AA. You know, before I made the decision to really leave AA altogether, I had a couple false starts after that first drink. I tried to come back. I was put in a psych ward for being suicidal. Some police showed up at my house. They asked me if I was suicidal. I said no, and then they came in, and there was a post-it note to my mom that said, "Dear Mom, if I die, it was an accident." And that's because I was on pills again and a lot of Jack Daniels, and some AA people were like, you know, ruined your drinking, AA. And they were like really on me about how dangerous the combination was. My mom was in Europe, and so I wanted her to just in case know that it wasn't purposeful. The cops found that, took me off to the psych ward. And after that, because that's the time to leave AA, I was done. And I lasted 4 months. And because I had a history and a relationship with people in Alcoholics Anonymous, someone called me, and thank God they did, because I was not getting anywhere. I mean, I wasn't even able to leave my room. You know, that those four hideous horsemen, frustration, bewilderment, what are they? Lonely, frustration and despair. Those were my compadres. I couldn't leave the house. I tried to go out and drink one night with some guy. Midtown Young People's Group has a weird, you can like go find other people that have left and they'll like bring you out like into, it's hard to even explain. You know what I'm talking about? Like you can call people that were once in AA and go out drinking with them. It's so weird. I was never able to do it because I couldn't get out of the house. So this guy was like planned a night. We were going to go to all these bars. I could not do it. I mean, I was at that point, my drinking and my alcoholism, my spiritual sickness had advanced so much because it is progressive, you guys. I couldn't leave the house. I just wanted to drink alone. And if I had a bunch of pills, I wouldn't drink. I only say that because it's part of my experience. I have nothing but respect for our primary purpose, and I'm an alcoholic, and that's it. But I've tried to manage my alcoholism, like a lot of times with pills, because the drunk slob kebab blackout thing can become troublesome quickly. And anyway, somebody called me, and I had spent 2 days trying to install my laptop to my printer so I could print out a resume, and I just kept giving up. This is something that I could do in my sleep in some sort of fit spiritual condition. And I could not, it was like beyond me, you know what I mean? That's me. That's the unmanageability that it talks about in the first step, you know, that we're powerless over alcohol. Our lives had become unmanageable. It's not just the financial, you know, burdens and the not being able to pay my bills. I can't make a decision, you guys. I can't figure anything out. I can't leave the house because it's way too much. The grocery store is completely off the table. I just can't do any of that. It's beyond me. I have no power. And I didn't know any of this. I mean, I thought I did. I could talk about it. I think I'd read the book and stuff. But when I went back to that meeting, I didn't even know I was going back to get sober. You know, my friend Jack, God bless him, he called me. He said, "Johnny's here. He'd like to see you." And I just was mortified because this man, Johnny, had helped me get sober the first, like, that first year and a half. He'd helped me, and it was a big part of my sobriety. And I was so ashamed of myself, and I thought, well, I'll go to this meeting for Johnny out of loyalty to him. And I went there, and I thought I was just going there to rise above my illness and still show up for this man, although not sober, that had loved me up, you know? And, you know, as alcoholics, we do have consciences. We do, and we do love deeply, and we are painfully desperate to be loved. We can't facilitate all this. We have no power. And so the whole thing, just for me, the fear of, you know, what is it, the fear? It's that you're going to get to know me, and you're going to say, go away. You know, go away. You're a mess. Go away. I can't love you. You're unlovable. So go away. And but I walked in there anyway, and I've been coming back ever since. And it did take me a year from then to get sober. You know, once again, like unsober was too much. The insomnia was too much. I do weird things, you guys, to not be sober. I'm not going to get into the details of it because if you want to ask me about it, I'll share it. But I don't want to create any confusion. But trust me that for me, it is vitally important that I have no mood or mind or altering substance from the neck up because my mind can't handle it. I do a lot of weird stuff with pretty much anything that alters my perception. So it took me a year to get really, really sober again, but I did. And from that time till now, it's been a whole different deal. There's really been no guys. There's been not much happening in the material world, if you will, to divert me from this path. And there have been times where I have thought, I'm going to commit suicide. This is awful. You know, and to push through that, there is no, and I remember my grand sponsor telling me, Stephanie, no one's coming to bail you out, and I knew it was right. And when you really learn that lesson at depth, or I shouldn't say learn the lesson, because we're really capable of unlearning at any time anything, but when I knew that was right, when I knew what he meant, you know, I mean, that is a soundbite that I've carried with me from that day to this, you know, a little over 3 years ago. He said we were at a bonfire, and I just was telling him how hard it was and how unfair it was and, you know, how can, you know, Felipe's married. I mean, this is like, I'm like alone, like, you know, and he just said, no one's coming to bail you out, honey. No, it was both the worst news ever and the best truth ever for me because, you know, I started to do this with no one even seeing me. I mean, my sponsor was like, you've got to carry the message. And I got a commitment at a jail. And I've been doing that for a little over 2 years. And I didn't want to do it so bad, you guys, and I almost got a different sponsor. You know, it's a 45-minute drive. Just the bureaucracy to get the job alone was bringing me down. I mean, every week there was another hoop to jump through. I've never even been to jail. You know what I'm saying? So I felt very much like it wasn't in, but the truth of the matter is the ladies in the prison relate to me a lot. And, you know, they don't pay attention to me as an alcoholic necessarily, but they relate to the way I think. And that's the best I can do in there. And I'm not going to pretend like I love my prison commitment. I hate going there every other Tuesday. I dread it with a stomach ache. But when I leave, I feel totally different every time. You know, and that's been my experience in the last 3 years is that I haven't wanted to do anything I've done. That's the truth about me. I'm not one of these AA members that's my best friend Joyce in AA is one of these members. She's like all over the map in service. She sponsors like 20 people. I mean, she is like bionic in AA. I am like lethargic in AA. I'm like her polar opposite. And that was really hard for me in the first couple of years because everybody was like, Joyce! And then they'd be like, hey, Steph, how you doing? And I was just like, you know, because that was me, like, wow. You never knew what you were going to get. Or if I was smiling, it would, like, shock people, like, you look like you're coming around. And it was always felt very, you know, like, so, but it started, basically what started to happen to me, and it's happening. I mean, it's only 3 years. It's just happening, and it's very up and down. I mean, I go through JAGs. Probably, you know, every few weeks where I just get leveled and I have to surrender again, like painful surrenders. I still haven't gotten down what I just read this in. If you have that book, The New Pair of Glasses, there's a chapter called The Power of Truth. I'm reading it right now and it's so good. He talks about infinite surrender, infinite journey, infinite surrender. And he says there will never come a day where I will not have to surrender. He calls it the burr in the saddle. And that's basically, I know that's true, but I still fight it sometimes, often. But I've kept going, and I haven't run away from it. And my, you know, there's certain things I still fight. My grand sponsor sent me a text yesterday. It said, forget self today. Forget self. And I thought, let me ask you a question. How are we supposed to do that? I mean, I'm in here. You know what I mean? And I still have that reaction sometimes, that defiant. That's how I'm wired, this power-driven defiance, but things have started to work. Images, the littlest things, like, take your foot off the pedal, Stephanie. No one's trying to hurt you here. They're trying to help. You know what I mean? Take your foot off the pedal. And, you know, am I making my life, on this day, have I cherished someone's existence? Have I rained down some love somewhere? Have I sowed that seed of pure love for no reason other than to do it anywhere? And if I haven't, I feel afraid. Because it has been shown to me in droves. I mean, it is, like, mind-blowing how much love I've been shown in Alcoholics Anonymous. I can't pretend to understand it fully. And I don't, I'm not there yet to where I can sow it the way I would like to. But I am trying. I can say that with certainty. I am trying. You know, I pray for God to speak through me. After I talk, I always feel mortified. Like, you know, you feel vulnerable and exposed, and you kind of drive home like, ugh. But I just want to have a message of hope for someone. My message of hope goes to those dark, dark horses that are so broken, and that's many of us, most of us, that even in, I mean, my sponsor's been going through a hard time lately, and she has leaned on me, and I have gotten the good fortune of seeing up close and personal a member of AA go through real pain that's sober a long time. That's just a woman among women in AA. That this idea that our sponsors are not allowed to struggle or, you know, have to surrender at depth again. Sorry, Val. that's not real or true. I mean, I now that I'm looking, I see it everywhere because I'm awake to it, and I am able to be somebody that can go in there and be side by side with people that are going through things that are so difficult and not be afraid of it. I mean, I have walked through cancer with a friend of mine who was given, you know, 10 months to live. She beat it, thank God, but in there, in the hospital, not afraid. I have been with people on the firing lines. I've been so lucky, just, you know, I mean, I've had newcomers be so mean to me. I've had one lady tell me if she died, it was going to be my fault. Like, I mean, I'm in there with the bad drinkers, you know, and not always, but that's where I end up, not because I, like, try. I just, God puts me there. And I feel like, you know, the things that pin me to the most to the mat still are my idea of what it's supposed to look like. You know, I mean, sometimes I'm 43. I will get in this fear that is so visceral that, you know, I'm going to die alone. You know that fear? Anyone familiar with it? That it's so bad, it'll put me in like this state where I feel like I can't breathe. The histrionics just start mounting. I'm like, this is awful. Oh my God. And I, you know, I'm never going to be, I'm unlovable. I don't even know if I'm attractive. I mean, who can tell if you haven't dated in a long time? How am I to know? I mean, I'm looking out here for it. I don't get it out here. It's in here and I'm not getting it from in here. This is what it feels like when I'm in these jags. And, thank God for my sponsor because that's, you know, and God. And that's very much what this path has been about. My sponsor directs me back to God. I've used to fight with her. I mean, this is my experience. Aren't you going to give me direction? She said, Stephanie, you have had every direction. You need to trust God. You need to see that what you're, just like the Chuck's, I read it in the book recently. I'm like, hey, you got that from Chuck C. She's like, I know. She's like, my sponsor got it from Chuck C. and told it to me that what you're looking for, you're looking with. And those kind of things didn't resonate with me, you know, years back. People would say that stuff, and I'd be like, ooh, but I would think it was like a Hobbit-like riddle. I mean, now I understand what that means, you know, and I feel in a way, although, you know, in the outside, like the material plane, I don't have, my life is not, you know, it doesn't look like, I don't think it looks like what, like your standard citizen would qualify as successful, have a lot of debt still, you know, I'm not like, I don't know, I'm not going to go down that road, but I don't think that I have that. But what I do have is this sense, this true desire to just help rain down love, you know, and I'm starting to really see that if I do that, that I am useful. I am useful. Like, it's there's more to life than procreation if I don't get to be a mom. Like, I didn't think that. If 3 years ago, I would have said, that's not true. It's my rite of passage as a woman, and if I cannot be a mom, then there's just no point to this thing. That's the whole point to this thing, is to, you know, and it's not true. And just the continuing to try to, you know, face outward to you guys and be helpful, you know, and it's starting to work, I think. Some days I can't tell for sure, but then there's days that I think I can feel it. You know, today driving here, I could feel it. It was so beautiful. The sky was so beautiful. It was like I was overwhelmed with its beauty. You know, I just thought, dear sky, rock on. I mean, I couldn't believe it. And then I'm awake to feel the gratitude of just a day with you guys. You know, just a day with my 85-year-old mom. My dad died a few years ago, and I was not very good to him during his illness. I was very obsessed with that wedding. And, there's still work to be done there. But with my mom, you guys, I'm awake. If I'm with her and we're at the kitchen table talking, I know how valuable it is. A lot of people don't realize that till later. I'm in there, in it. I don't end that conversation 1 second early. There's nothing that's more important to me than my mom telling me about the L.L. Bean slipper she wants for the 10th time. And I will sit there and be like, I think you're right. I think you're right that those would be too hot for summer. I think you should get these. And we'll circle the magazine and we'll, and I'm in there, you know. And so that's basically, if I am learning anything, I hope it's that there really isn't anything to get here. And that used to, I mean, people would say that, there's nothing to get here. And I would be like, stop saying that. You know what I mean? Like, I couldn't stand hearing that. It literally felt like torture to hear that. Like, if there's nothing to get here, what am I going to do? What are we even doing? And we're trying to give. And then we get changed through that process. And I hope that, you know, it doesn't have to take 10 years to understand what alcoholism is. And I hope that I continue on this path, because I do also know it's precarious. I do know that I can go backwards anytime. I just want to skip praying, skip answering the phone. And I do it sometimes. But anyways, I am so grateful. Thank you, Sam. You are one of the most efficient speaker getters I've ever dealt with in my life. And I mean, I don't mean to say that I've dealt with a lot, but you guys are like making sure that the unmanageable alcoholic gets here. And it's unbelievable. I still asked you how long the talk was, and I went back and it was already there in the email. I was like, dang it. But, I mean, it was so welcoming, you know, coming in, this is where the clock is, would you like some water? The directions were perfect. You know, I mean, just, you guys are doing something so respectable here. And I just feel so grateful that for tonight I got to be a small part of it. And so thank you. Mm-hmm.